The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill starts to take advantage with pass keys. John gets commissioned, and we still don't know what service he was in. Maria gets to the edge of space. More fraud, spies, and lies, and another pitcher goes to bat. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Wednesday, July 5th, join our free Angel to Exit advisory session. Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Fred.
Sure. So what's the name of your company, and what do you do?
MedWatch Technologies, and we are a non-invasive continuous glucose monitoring company, and I'm the CEO of the company.
Okay, so when you say non-invasive continuous glucose monitoring, you're talking about diabetes, right?
That is correct.
And by the way, if we don't have diabetes, can we still use it, especially those of us that are getting close to the edge?
Right now, it's a prescription, or it will be a prescription-only device. However, if you don't have diabetes and you get a prescription for it, anybody could use it. Some people may want it for monitoring their overall health or for fitness, performance athletes, whatever the case might be.
In my case, you know, they measure my blood every so often, and sometimes I'm closer to being diabetic. They'll call it pre-diabetic or, you know, whatever. And then sometimes I'm further away. And part of it is you learn how to eat, what to eat, when to eat, and so forth, and how to deal with your body by having that measurement capability in near real time, right?
Absolutely. Having that information is really valuable. It allows you to see what foods affect yourself, and it allows you to be the champion of your own health.
So one of the things that about medicine that I dislike is, let's see, the intervention of the medical community in knowledge about yourself. And these sorts of sensor technologies coming out now are really changing the dynamic of that. Can you just talk about what your sensors do and where they sit in that spectrum?
Well, our first product will be our glucose detection product. However, we currently have, but we may not release it until after our first product, but we do non-invasive blood pressure measurement. We do heart rate variability, respiration rate, blood oxygen, all non-invasively in our device.
I'm starting to get it. The idea here, as I understand, is basically a watch that sits on your arm, or a patch that goes over a device that sits on your arm, whatever it is. It doesn't penetrate, but it looks through. It uses some special frequencies of LEDs and transmits and looks for the reflection coming back. And from that, it figures out what these conditions are. Is that basically right?
That is correct. Our first product will be a patch. We do have a watch on the roadmap. But yes, we do it with lighter LEDs, and we use an artificial neural net to help us interpret those values.
All right. So when you say an artificial neural net, these are, you know, words from AI, which is supposed to be artificially intelligent. But really, these are trained mechanisms that use feedback to set a set of settings so they can see something that they've seen before and say, ah, it's one of those. Is that basically right?
Basically, that's correct.
All right. So where does this AI neural network run? Is it run right on the device, or does it run out in the cloud, or where does it run?
It will run on the app on your smartphone.
All right. So I need a smartphone. I can't have a dumb phone.
Correct.
Does my smartphone then talk directly to the watch, and or does it go to the cloud, or how does that work?
The app will talk to the patch directly via Bluetooth, but then we take and push the data from the phone to the cloud, to where you will have all your data, and you at your choosing can share it with your family member, trusted individual, and your healthcare provider or providers.
Yeah. At my choosing, can I choose to have it on my phone and not send out to the cloud?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I can actually have a reasonable level of privacy. And we're going to forget about all the cybersecurity technology of being able to interfere with the Bluetooth and all this stuff. So the FDA has just come out with requirements for medical devices that interact with the body that say that there has to be special cybersecurity protection for anything that goes out to the internet. So do you have special cybersecurity protection for this device or not?
We do, and all that's being developed. And our CTO can speak to that better than I can.
Yeah, well, but we're talking to you now, so we'll just say, you know, the magicians know it. Okay, good. And by the way, when people want to drill down into the company and find out more details, they can go to thecybershow.co and click on the link that takes them to the GWiz for your company. That's the Growth Wizards. And they'll be able to drill down and get access or contact people that can then tell them the answers to these questions, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Those of us that grew up in the Star Trek area know that, you know, Dr. McCoy had this device that he went over your body and went whatever it did, and it picked up on all your body signs. And we're actually getting close to that, right?
Absolutely. The device, if you're a Trekkie, you're referring to the tricorder. My vision is basically for you to be wearing your tricorder, and we can monitor a whole host of things. And we've got future generations in the roadmap, so it's going to be quite powerful.
Okay, so technically that's not the tricorder. The tricorder is the box you carry around. We're talking about that little thing that McCoy has, that little cylindrical thing that he puts up to your body, right? Do we know what the name of that was?
I don't remember that offhand.
All right, so for Trekkie fans in the audience, what's the name of the device that McCoy used that's the little medical thing? We want you to email to the show to let us know, and then we'll, on the air, we'll provide your answer and we'll give your name with it if you can tell us what the magical device was that McCoy used.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
And now from the news desk, more news from thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. The tensions in Russia have risen of late because of the internal turmoil. Here from the top floor of the St. Regis in Moscow, we see a lot of people rushing around. Air raid signs are going off. And now, what's that?
It's very bright.
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years. One last segment. I'd like to know, so have you retired? What are you doing today? And, you know, what do you think for the future?
Well, in the very near future, I will count my 88th birthday. I have work, which is what I do for the joy of it. I have business, which is what I do for the money. Fortunately for me, I don't need the money because my clients have all died or retired. So I don't really have very much business, but I do have a lot of work, and I do it mostly for the joy of it. It's expressed in my blog. It's expressed in LinkedIn.
Okay, but instead of letting us to read it, this is the radio, you need to tell us. What are you working on? What's interesting?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting right this minute, one of the things I would like to see us all promoting is passkeys.
A hardware device we carry around that we become dependent upon.
Well, but it's the most convenient form of user authentication, and it's resistant to replay. You know, in my browser, I plug in my user ID once, and every time I connect to your system, you see my user ID. You go out and you get my public key that you stored on your system. You encrypt the challenge under it. You send it to me. I decrypt it with my private key and return the value to you, and you say, that's Murray. But all of that was done under the covers at your end and mine. Nobody had to intervene. It's the most convenient form and the safest form of user identification and authentication, and it needs to be actively promoted and adopted as quickly as possible, particularly since we tend to associate privilege now with a particular user identity.
I tend not to do things that way, right? I do understand what you're saying. I use what I call identifiers and authenticators. And the use of the identifier and the authenticator are not necessarily associated with human beings. It's an identifier, something to identify the authorization of what you're supposed to do, and the authenticator to authenticate that you're authorized to do that thing. And it's all controlling functions that you're authorized to do. In many ways, like what you were talking about earlier.
You and I are users of other people's applications.
Well, no, actually, I am a user of other people's applications, but more often than not, I write my own applications and I just don't use their applications. So, you know, my general view of this is no, I'm not going to use somebody else's application. I'll write my own, you know, for infrastructure that I run, as opposed to, you know, infrastructure that I use, you know, so we're using Google Meet or whatever, right? So I'm just using whatever they use and I just don't care. It's sitting in an environment that's reasonably safe. And if it's a Trojan horse, so be it, right? It won't do enough harm for me to care about it. But for most of the things that I do, I have to be physically present. If I am not in my office, the vast majority of the functions that I do will not be done. And I'm not a big fan of the everything from anywhere, anytime approach to the world. That's why, right? Because I don't need all those other controls. All that interdependency that's created by the intervening infrastructure becomes unnecessary if you have a combination of physical controls and logical controls. Does that make sense?
Yes. Nobody's doing it that way.
Oh, I am. So, look, when I work with people that are, you know, wealthy people, family offices, and so forth, yeah, they do want to be able to spend money wherever they are and use their iPhone for everything, but usually they have an actual office. And they spend much of their work time in the actual office. And when it comes to doing multi-million dollar transactions, it's okay to do it from the office. There's almost never an occasion where you have to do that, you know, $20 million transaction from your cell phone.
Well, what do you think, Chris?
Oh, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin?
So you think it's a waste of time he used the term quality. And as he used it, and you've described your, you know, view of the world, I'm increasingly thinking that we just ask too much of a too complicated world, and it's never going to be achievable. And you can see that, you know, when I take my analytical perspective on things and actually do the analysis, I'm utterly convinced it's not achievable. But at the same time, you know, I'm trying to fight the good fight.
Right. I guess. Yeah, my perspective is always, you know, countered by the fact that, you know, biology works, right? You know, we got here, you know, 4 billion years later, because despite all of the actual lack of planning and, you know, coordination and well thought out process and so forth, you know, order can, you know, can increase, you know, in some cases.
Sure. Right? All of those fantastic other life forms that didn't make it because of random chance, and we're the survivors.
Right.
I mean, think about how poor that system is, that we are the top of the food chain.
Or you know, and again, I think you know, original sin and you know, ideas like hubris, you know, have shackled us forever. It's like I see us as the sentient part of an otherwise, you know, perhaps entirely inanimate universe. You know, and the one part of the universe that has gotten so, you know, so successful that we can turn around and look at it and say, wow. We could even be better. And, you know, we look at ourselves, you know, this wasn't planned, right? You know, the, you know, as I get older, you know, and history gets shorter, right? 100 years ago is just, you know, I was born, you know, beyond the midpoint of that, right? You know, in the age direction, and 100 years before that, how did people make decisions? How do we get things done? How do we, you know, it's hard to imagine, right? You know, without any of this, without pencils.
But, you know, the idea of the romantic past, first of all,
forget that. No, it's kind of horrific past. You know, I'm amazed we made it. But looking forward, you know, I see largely imperfect systems that are perfectly fine. right? You know, so I don't think we're going to get all the errors out of everything. I think, like everything else in life, they won't matter. You know, the ones that you know, the errors we don't solve are errors that, you know, disappear in Heisenberg fuzz.
Yeah, all right. So as you like it.
As you like it.
Yeah, my preferred thought process tells me that if we work diligently and carefully, we can have a better life.
But not exclusive. You know, I work very diligently, very hard, and I think it, you know, makes a difference. I've had a great life, but you know, I think it's just, we set the goal, right? And I think more of it, you know, it's more of a, you know, the impact of actual life today. It's like, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I could be better. We should be better. We're a terrible species. What is that ahead? It doesn't move anything forward.
No, I didn't say we're a terrible species. All I really said was we are so incredibly flawed that the notion of thinking of ourselves as being somehow elite must really degrade the concept of elite.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. I think that's, you know, if and when, you know, our individuals in our species live for thousands and millions of years, or if anybody out there is doing that already, I think that's one of the first things you learn. Right. You know, there is no perfect. There's no getting it all right. I think the very concept of these utopian supernatural creatures, you know, it's logically incorrect. You know, what is perfect? What is all powerful? That makes no sense.
Well, but you see, you're going to an extreme. I didn't say perfect, nothing like that. All I'm saying is that we are so flawed. We are so foolish.
But flawed and foolish are judgmental. But those are judgmental words. I would say, you know, instead of flawed, I would say that's a feature, right? You know, I think our imperfection is, again, a judgmental word. It's, you know, we don't fit the structure by definition. Humans are things that don't, as Terry Pratchett put it, you know, that don't have a good definition.
One of the things, you know, that comes to mind is you look at natural language processing and large language model AI of today, and I look at it and I say it's so flawed, and I look at people, I say we're so flawed, and it starts to convince me that maybe that AI is getting close.
Right, right.
Because as much as I know it's far away, it may be far away from the best I can do, but probably it's way better than the average that the average person can do.
Well, because this is, you know, with my, you know, place on the spectrum is one thing that all my life has, you know, iteratively sort of terrified me. When you look at, okay, how do I get a handle on this whole universe thing? And you say, oh, that's right, you can't, right? Too much, too big, time is too short, too much to process. And, you know, so dividing it into chunks that you can actually manage at all is a remarkable thing. And so I think flaws, you know, what we see as flaws are the mechanisms that we have that allow us to stop. You know, a little voice inside say, you know, you can go all the way into that crack and figure out all the things, and you probably should. And you go like, yeah, can't be done. Don't have time.
The other side of that is, so the day comes when we replace our imperfection with the imperfection of automation, and we just relax about it and don't worry about it. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, just what we're doomed to.
I think we'll always, yeah, we're warriors, right? So me and Donna have been together 40 years. And in the first decade or two, a lot of the strife came from my picture that I, as spouse, you know, should solve problems for my partner. And I would, you know, so I'd hear, oh, you know, I'm doing this thing and it's driving me nuts. And I would say, okay, I'll do that. And I find out Donna's doing something else that's driving her nuts, because doing things that driving you nuts is kind of what life is, right? So I don't think that we're going to lie back ever. Yeah, I think we'll, you know, find that we're not stressing about trying to make sure we read the 37 pages and made all the highlights, because AI is way better at that. And we'll worry about other things.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say.
And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
So we're back with John Tippett, and John has just been to his bookshelf and pulled out, I guess, books that are the reports from how many commissions did you end up working on, John?
Well, five that I can prove.
Okay, well, let's just start with those five.
Four that I can prove, but another probably half dozen that were all classified, so I can't prove it.
Oh, okay. Well, you could prove it if it was necessary, but all right. So it might come to 10 or 11.
Okay. Yeah. I could prove it and then shoot them.
Right. I tell you, but then I have to shoot you. Okay. So obviously nothing classified on the radio show. So let's walk through the commissions. Give us the brief overview of all the commissions you worked on and what you did for them.
Well, to put it in context, in 92, when I went into business for myself, thanks to our government, I have the first 4 or 5 years were actually consumed by the agency and the NASA and programs. And I was even recalled into the Navy, not recalled into the Navy, but brought back as a consultant because they were moving from a classified stealth ship to what was going to be considered an unclassified stealth ship.
It's unclassified and you can't find it. Okay. If you want to explain that to the audience, that's great, but I'm not even going to ask.
Yeah, well, it didn't last long. In fact, I remember sitting before the SAPOC. The SAPOC was the Special Access Program Control Committee, and it was comprised of 3 admirals and a White House guy, and I don't remember what his title was. But I said, first of all, the ship itself, if you declassify it, because of what we're planning to put into the real ship, would be compromised severely by declassifying the demonstrator, because the demonstrator demonstrated a lot of things that worked very well, and it demonstrated some things that didn't work so well. And if you declassify all of that, any analyst worth his salt would quickly understand what the ship actually has. Now, they were still planning a fleet of these, right? And so that lasted about 4 months, 5 months maybe. And then the SAPOC made a recommendation to the National Security Council that they not do that. And so they didn't. Now, the problem was the CNO had already released pictures of the
Thank you. Okay.
But no technical details. I mean, you know, you just look at this pretty thing. But if you take some of the modern warships that have been built in the last 10 years or so, and then hold up the Sea Shadow and look at these new ships, you can tell who their father was. All right. So the first commission that I can talk about was the legislation on governmental secrecy prepared for the Subcommittee on Intergovernmental Relations of the Committee on the Government Operations United States Senate. This was one of the earliest looking at the secrecy issue, and it really went nowhere. I mean, it was done, it was presented. They didn't even do a classified version of it. So that was the first one.
It was the unclassified commission on classified stuff.
Well, that never had a classified addendum because no one would ever approve the release of the information. The data owners would never release the information.
Okay, so they studied it. They just refused to release even a classified version of it.
Right. It was something that was political. And so everyone tried to stay the heck away from it as much as they possibly could. Then the next one that I can talk about is in 85. And this is the Keeping the Nation's Secrets. This is a report to the Secretary of Defense by the Commission to Review DOD Security Policies and Practices. This was a commission that came out of a couple of the spy cases. And so,
which spy cases, if you recall?
It was Hansen. Well, the funny part of that story was his wife was the one that had turned him in twice to the FBI, and they did nothing. On the third time, they opened a case. And in the meantime, while that was going on, of course, he had brought his son into the fight. Yeah. But those gave rise to this commission. And what made this more important than the previous one is that it was specific. I mean, there were objectives. There was a free-for-all in terms of what should be done from a management point of view. How did the current architecture match with current threats and evolving threats? And I was I started out in this particular study, as I did in most of these, as a witness, where I was called to make a presentation and give my conclusions and so forth and so on. And the reason that I had got the invitation was because at the time, a couple of years before that, I'm a member of the National Security Committee of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco. And back then, we had an admiral that was the head of the our section, National Security Section, and we actually did a study on secrecy in America and we had the CIA come talk to us. We had NSA. We did a really bang-up job. And that report, which I've got a copy of here somewhere, was what someone involved in this particular commission had read and invited me to come in, and because I was a co-author of that report. So, I mean, some of the questions we took on was, for an example, the question of whether our classification system met our needs or did it need to change?
Yeah, and what was the answer?
The answer was it met our needs, but there were improvements that could be made. So there were several recommendations, most of which were entertained, not necessarily implemented the way that maybe some of us would have wanted it to, but they did make substantial improvements.
You know, as much as I love recording, you know, podcasts and conversations like this and recording these with you, and I was trying to think of how, you know, if you're listening to this and you want to get value out of this, right? You know, you have to understand as you look to put together your cybersecurity infrastructure, where we are in time, right? You know, the people who helped us take a classification system in the U.S. federal government level that, you know, post-World War II was like, let's assume the greatest, most successful thing in its class, and map it to the world we live in now. You know, this is not a long, long time ago, right? You know, so look at the maturity of policy and implementation and guidelines and so forth. Keep in mind, you know, this wasn't written by Plato, right? This hasn't been tested for thousands of years. We're still building it.
When I listen to John talking about these things, it's just one thing after another where he's in a circumstance, in a situation where he just has gained the knowledge through his efforts, and turns out that what he gained through his efforts is really valuable. And we all have efforts, right? Everybody does what they do. They try hard to do things that they're interested in and they want to do. But his success at this, in this arena, is beyond anybody I know of, by a long way. Okay. And it's just astonishing the things he's been involved with. And I've done work on things with John, and it's wonderful to work with him, right? I can't tell you how wonderful it is to work with him, because just like, you know, talking to Bill Murray, you know, we don't agree about everything,
obviously. But we learn from each other all the time. He has so much stuff to learn about. And you start to drill into this stuff. We did a study looking at turning behavior. And we looked at every case, you know, at the whatever classification levels, every case in the United States government of turning behavior, where somebody who was previously loyal or believed to be loyal turned out to become disloyal and ended up doing something unauthorized, associated typically with classified information, because that is the domain we tend to be working in. And you go through that process, and it's not just the minutiae you learn. You learn these meta things about the way it works. In the context, before I had done that, I worked on a set of issues surrounding deception and counter-deception, including studying all the psychological literature I could find on it. So a couple of years in that, and then a couple of years in the next thing, and the next thing, and you start to piece together a picture of how the world works and why it works that way, and you start to understand how to make these decisions better and what's lacking in these decisions. And figuring out that methodology is really just takes a lot of time and effort and thought to come up with these methodologies. And he's done it again and again and again with great success repeatedly.
All the folks, you know, we have here, you know, particularly John, it's, you move chaotically with in structure, right? You know, you, everything's fractal. You can't nail it all down. As we discussed in a lot of these recordings, you know, there's no perfect. So even in a path like John's or yours or mine that have been, you know, notable, it's not like we had it figured out. And it's not like it was completely random. It's kind of both, right? You know, you have to structure your, put yourself in the right kind of place. Or if you find yourself in that place, say, oh, I'm in this place, and see where that leads to.
Smart people come to understand these things. But there was a saying about the Army back, certainly from World War II. I don't know where it originated. A system created by geniuses for execution by idiots. And that seems to me that that's what we're lacking. In the internet, in the development of the technology, you talk about the folks who created ChatGPT, and the guy who led the team to create it is out here saying, you know, I wish I hadn't done it. Oops. And this sort of thing, and the cat's out of the bag. But there are thoughtful people in the world, and most people are not that. Increasingly, at the highest level of governance in corporations, in nation states, and across the world, I see it slipping away. That governance is not willing to pay attention to that, not willing to make those decisions, good decisions, and over a long period of time execute on them. And that's why we have global climate change, and you can disagree that it exists, but I, you know, the storms are here. That's, I think, you know, why we have the long-term failure in our national education system in the United States, and you know, all the gun violence. I think most of the ills of society are related to that. It's because of influence operations and the failure to have thoughtful people able to get things done in leadership positions.
I guess I put a lot of faith in, you know, just the organic mechanism, you know, that John Alsup, you know, said to me after he started building Borderware, and someone said, there's not enough IP addresses. Ah, you know, lost my mind. Somebody did a neat documentary on that, you know, interviewed John Mays, you know, NAT, network address translation, just spontaneously arose at almost exactly the same time, same year, 1992, three different groups of people acting independently, you know, came up with exactly the same thing. And yeah, right before we did that, you know, I ran to my boss's office and said, ah, and he didn't blink an eye, and he said something I'll never forget. You know, when there's enough need, a technical fix is found. Now, this whole information integrity, human information integrity, disinformation, influence campaigns, and everything else, you know, this is, you know, not all cyber. However, you know, our cyber landscape is at a initial level of maturity, you know, to deal with that. You know, the technical tools, fact-checking and so forth by human beings that we kind of hope to trust. Look, you know, we're at the very, very early stages of that. You know, so I have a lot of hope, but this is one that concerns me. You know, as much as possible, year to year, we need to, all of us, in every, whether we're consuming information or making these systems or whatnot, keep thinking about how we have a virtual commons that works at least as well as, you know, the small town that it really is.
Wednesday, July 5th, join our free Angel to Exit advisory session. For more details or to sign up, Follow the link on thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Maria, who is one of the early women in the cyber world. She's had an amazing career starting as a programmer, and, well, let's see where she goes from there. Maria, welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Just fine. All right. So after you survived the first, you know, virus attack at NASA.
Yeah.
What was the next, you know, interesting thing in your career?
Basically, cybersecurity was born, right? Incident
for,
response.
For you. It was born for you.
It was also born for NASA, right? And the government. And so all that, you know, was well documented. Of course, who was the person who could document? So I had a lot to do with that. But you could probably attribute that incident to the birth of the profession of cybersecurity, right?
You could. You cybersecurity could. Has been around for a long time.
For a long time. Yeah.
But I mean, that was your first cybersecurity child.
Yeah. And probably the one that got the most attention at that point in history.
So now, all right. So what happened next, guys? You're beyond the virus thing. So what did you end up creating and running the global certs, or what did you do next?
What did I do next? Well, I stayed at NASA until 1997.
Still doing just computer programming or running?
Yeah, actually, I left the NAS facility and joined the ARCLAN after that, which is the Ames Research Center local area, basically the management of all of, instead of just NAS and the supercomputers, it was all of Ames Research Center. And what we were tasked with, since we were so familiar with the Unix machines like the Suns and the Silicon Graphics, they basically handpicked us to be the team that took all of NASA into the next generation of computing from networked sort of dumb terminals, remember?
Mainframes,
distributed, exactly. And so I was on the NASA systems acquisition team. And so it was not just for Ames, it was actually for every NASA facility.
Does that include the stuff that goes up into space?
Actually, it did. We actually just wrote requirements for it, you know, and because...
So you were on the acquisition team for the computers that took us into space and
to the next generation.
To the moon,
exactly.
I guess.
Yeah. And actually, that's my team. There was a team of six of us on that team. And we were the first non-mission team. In other words, the non-astronaut, like a team that didn't have to go out into space, that actually won the NASA Group Achievement Award. So we became the first team to do that. Because of
your achievements.
Yeah, because of our achievements.
So did you ever want to go into space and couldn't make it, or did you really not want to go? You'd much rather have them get blown up.
I did want to go into space. I was always like that. But I knew that I had.
You still have a chance, right?
Yeah, until I saw the Challenger blow up. And then
oh, that gave you a negative thought towards that?
Yeah.
No, but they're starting to have regular space missions. You know, you could go on SpaceX or one of those guys.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I'm too old now. And no,
that's funny. You're never too old to go to space.
That's true. I can't remember.
That's another issue.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. You know, because when I worked at NAS, they had a huge room, you know, wall to wall. A big, just wall-to-wall monitor, probably the biggest live wall and first live wall that I ever knew of, you know, that I personally saw. So every time there was a mission, especially the shuttle mission, in the morning you'd come in and grab donuts and coffee. It was a good place to work. And they had them every morning. And you could go in there and watch the launches. They'd have them on. Whatever NASA was doing was on this big screen all the time, pretty much.
Okay, so now she's in charge of all of the acquisition of all the computers going into space or being used anywhere at NASA. Okay.
Right.
And this is, you know, this is a Trekkie, right? So
That's got to be, wow, okay. All that stuff on that where the computer does stuff and all the Star Trek episodes, I guarantee you she watched those episodes and said, oh, that's what I want to buy. Or, oh, ours doesn't look like that. We fixed that problem.
Well, you see this over and over and over again, right? You know, but the so many things, you know, can't be done, right? You know, we've all watched the same sci-fi and so forth, and it's easy to say, you know, this can't be done, that can't be done. However, we have individuals, you know, who will take the time and have the opportunity, as you said, to just do it, right? And continue to move it forward. The number of things that we do technically in the cyber world today that I have heard, you know, the undisputed pundits of the world saying we can't do in my lifetime are countless, right? You know, yes, we can build space systems to do all this. So we can have security, you know, to the level we need to run these things. And quite often without doing a lot of the things that we probably should do, because it's a complicated world.
I find that most people do all sorts of things for security they don't need to do and don't do the few things for security that they do need to do. And, you know, this has to do with being more thoughtful. But part of it is, I think most people that are engaged in the activity don't really have a deep understanding of what they're doing. Their notion is we need everything. We need to be able to detect anything and everything. We need to be able to react to it. We need to be able to prevent it. We need to be able to make sure that we can verify everything about everything all the time, these sorts of things. And the most important part of that, and we've talked about this for years, right, is, you know thyself, right? It's that if you understand what's actually going on and why things are the way they are, then you can figure out what's important and do the things that are important. And you can figure out what's critical to be fast and do those things fast enough, but not do other things so fast, you know, because it's expensive. And then the other thing is burden. A lot of the stuff we have, we architected so it's got more and more burden, especially on the end user, who is like the, first of all, the most overburdened person in the space anyway, because they have stuff to get done besides, you know, your cybersecurity stuff. But maybe more importantly, you keep interfering with their ability to do their job. And their boss says, hey, why is it taking you so long? And the answer is, can't be, oh, because I had to sign in 14 times and use three authenticators. And you know, that's just not an answer that's going to be acceptable. So what they'll do is they'll figure out a way around it. They'll say, okay, you know, I know work provides me with these computers, you know, but they're slow and impossible to use. You have to do 47 things just to go to a website. And my job is to go to websites and find stuff. So I'm just going to use my own computer, go to websites and find stuff. Well, how do I get it back in? I know, I'll just plug it in and they'll never know the difference.
Oh, well, I'll give you a perfect example, you know, as recently as today, right? You know, I am taking, again, SOC 2 compliance training, which normally I do by clicking on whatever link, you know, I'm supposed to go to.
Tell everybody what SOC 2 is.
Security something, something. It's some compliance you get that helps your company and insurance or qualifications.
Or banking or something. Okay, go ahead. Right. The answer is you're required to be trained on it, but you don't have to know what it is or why it is. And if you don't have to know, why are you going to bother? And by the way,
I'm literally going to this certified training site and playing the videos. Normally what I do is play the videos while I'm doing something else with the volume off and then just answer the questions at the end.
You have to watch the video or you're not allowed to answer the question.
This time I've actually watched the videos in between some calls and so forth, playing one at a time and actually watching what they're saying. And it's the worst advice I've seen in my life. Now, it is current accepted certified SOC 2 advice. It's what you're supposed to be trained in, which is to say, if you use email, don't trust it and don't trust people in general. And instead of clicking on a link, type in the URL. Now, what's a URL? A 700 character string of random characters. You're supposed to like type. No one's going to do any of that.
The idea that they say, oh, you know, all that stuff that makes it efficient and convenient and useful. Don't do that. No. Do the inefficient, useless. The other thing is, can you really even type the 14 character password without making a mistake?
Well, the worst of it is it explicitly says, really just don't trust people.
Hang on, let's go back to the 14 or 24 characters that you have to type without a mistake, and you only get three tries. So you do it, you make a mistake once, twice, three times. Now you're locked out. You can't get in at all.
Here's a measure of improvement. You know, apparently it's SOC 2 compliant now to advise people to actually use a passphrase, like four words, you know, and run them together, something you can remember. but you still have to change, you know, an O into a zero, an I into a one. Like, computers can't figure that out.
Right. Well, the other thing, of course, is my fingers don't work as well as they did when I was 20.
Right.
And I used to be able to type 150 plus words a minute, and now I'm, you know, probably down under 110, and, you know, and getting slower every day. And I make more mistakes. And my keyboard, because I've punched on it so much, you know, it gets weaker, so it misses some stuff. And so you know, it's really just a case of stop burdening us with things we don't want to do, really can't do well, shouldn't do. And if you really want us to not click on links, don't send them to us. You control the server. You can take it out.
Tactically, you may need to do whatever you may need to do. You know, Wednesday is still Wednesday. However, if you know, think of the long term, if you think in 50 years, in 100 years, in 500 years, this is the way it's going to be, you're wrong, you know, because we can't handle it. And now it's just bad security, you know, passwords and these compliance and training, you know, training users to not use the features. Okay, fine. It can't stay that way. You know, we have to build better technical systems because the consequences and threats, you know, and opportunities for adversaries continue to grow. So we'll get there. I guess my point of that rant is we're on a path of maturity, and this is a marker of where we are.
Tuesday, July 18th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the show, and make a fortune. No, we're not. For more details or to sign up, follow the link on thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're going to be talking with Tom Johnson about the cyber education world and how he got into it and his involvement, largely surrounding digital forensics and law enforcement and bringing forward cybersecurity into the world in large numbers.
He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man.
So after that time in New Haven, when I retired, then I said I went back to Sacramento to live, and that's when I started that forensic data center. And Bill Sperno.
Well, hang on. So the other thing we started was CalSci, right? You remember that was Larry DeNardis and you. And me and John Guinazzo and Leanna Dowidiak?
It could be, but CSI was so very important piece. So let's move from there to Webster, because this is where you really made an incredible contribution once again. So I get to Webster University, and I was there as Associate Vice President and Chief of Strategic Initiatives.
After your retirement from New Haven and some other years and doing some, you know, trying to start private companies, the forensic data center and such.
And I then, the University of Wisconsin asked me to come up and work with them in their criminal justice department. And I said, okay, but I probably can only stay a year. They said, that'd be fine. And so I was there for a year. And it was from there that Webster University called me to service.
Before you rush to Webster, let's just mention you also helped start programs in a few other places, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, so let's just get a quick list of all the countries and places where you helped to start these programs.
Okay. Well, I started a program at San Diego State University, started a program at Washington University in information security. I went to the University of Central Florida and assisted them in developing their computer crime program. And then at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, I assisted, Bill Sperno and I assisted in developing their computer crime sequence. And then I went to Sadie's University in Mexico, and I collaborated with their engineering school to set up some computer security program. Then, of course, the University of New Haven, we discussed, but Webster University, which I'll get to in a few minutes, the thing that I set up there that was so incredible that they never had, they didn't have cybersecurity before I got there.
All right, but how about Singapore? Go ahead. Walk around the globe, all the different police departments that you helped create the cyber programs for.
Well, I was at Taiwan University I was the Sino-American Criminal Justice Institute founder, and I put that in place at Taiwan University. Then the other thing, when I set up their cybersecurity program that they never had, and I set it up, and then I took it to military bases and to the regional campus site. So I was on 8 military bases with cybersecurity, and also I set up some regional campus programs, not only in the U.S., but also overseas, at our Netherlands campus in Leiden. In fact, I went to The Hague, and we were setting up a program at The Hague between the Leiden campus and our main campus.
And hang on, and other places around the world, those are not the only places, because Webster University has a lot of campuses around the world. So how many programs, how many different campuses did that end up getting deployed to?
I think offhand, maybe 3. I refused to take it to China. They wanted it at our China campus, and I refused to start it there because of all the problems that you get from China. But now you're saying a lot of other stuff with other things. I can give you some sense of. I worked as a special consultant to the U.S. State Department dealing in international law. And so basically, I was responsible for training foreign law enforcement agents in high technology and computer crime. Sometimes we talk risk management, but it was basically computer crime and information security. And I basically worked with people from 29 different nations. And
you don't have a list off the top of your tongue of the 29 other countries, not including previous 6 or 7. All right, sure, go through the list.
Okay. Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, Indonesia, Azerbaijan, Moldova, Georgia. In fact, I'll come back to talk about Georgia a little later. I almost set up a full-range program there. I was working with the Georgia military. It was interesting because Russia attacked them in 2008, and there was still KGB stuff happening. And I was, I can tell you that a little later. And then,
going through the list.
And then Ukraine, I was setting up a program there. Brunei, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Montenegro, Croatia, Serbia, Anglia, Botswana, Mozambique, South Africa, Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Peru, and Thailand.
But nothing in India.
No. The two most important ones was Georgia and Ukraine, and I could have had full programs in both those countries. In fact, the Georgia military, I was working with them in their top officials, and they really wanted the program there for sure. And so I helped them build it. So that was good. And so.
All right. So that's the 30 or so countries. Okay. We're talking here about setting up programs to educate and train law enforcement as well as public safety, and then the general capability for the countries in cybersecurity and in national security issues, right?
Right.
Okay. So now, if you want, you can go through the rest of Webster University.
Well, the other...
there are so many things you miss along the way, those 20 or 30 countries you would have not included.
There's the other thing that I wanted to let you know is I was doing visiting lectures at the U.S. Army War College, Carlisle Barracks, and also as a guest lecturer at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
The impact of a single person's life, right? Yeah, and with Tom, we're looking at the good.
But Johnny Cash, I've been everywhere, man.
I've been everywhere. Yes, Tom's story is just amazing, right? Like so many people we know. And yours, and whatever sent mine, you know, it's just a fascinating thing. But Tom, you know, stands out even among, you know, this crowd. The guy has been everywhere.
You know, he just, I forgot to mention those other 30 plus countries.
Right, the other 30.
The other, that's a different 30. No, that was the first 30. I mean, you know, I traveled the world when I was young, but, you know, setting up programs and, you know, I think the total came to about 38 or 39 countries. At the end, it was more than a dozen military bases. I think the master's program that he had at Webster University was running 250 plus master's students per year graduating, which is, I think, by far the largest thing in the world. Just incredible.
Yeah. It's, you know, I love watching open systems win, right? You know, this is the grand debate we're having, you know, and in my career, in Tom's career, you know, he's been at it, you know, longer than I have. We've gone from, in the cyber world, you know, closed systems. You know, it's going to be Burroughs. You buy the Burroughs, Sperry, Univac, IBM, and you know, buy it from us and everything else to this open internet, you know, which is really based on the principles of free speech, right? Let everybody go and the principles of capitalism, you know, let everyone, you know, be involved with it and let's see what works out. And in on the world stage, you know, the countries he's talking about where he would go and where he wouldn't go, the ones he wouldn't go to are not good at that. And, you know, you know, again, as we sit here today, the shining example, Russia, which has tried to, for 23 years, force down the closed system approach, that's not working out so well. So,
well, you know, so we don't know who's going to win yet. And, but, you know, I was in China and went to their campus in China. And what they did in China was they were just teaching, you know, English and other languages, which is fine. But I went there to talk about starting up the cybersecurity program. And I remember one of the things in China was people could not get out to the rest of the internet very well. So they were having a lot of problems. And that's still true, right? The great firewall of China is what they call it. But, you know, I wanted to start the cybersecurity program. And I had debates with Tom. And what it came down to was he just didn't feel comfortable bringing this knowledge to the Chinese, who were very competitive about it. But to continue with the great firewall story, sorry, I distracted myself. You know, we had to go back to the United States, you know, through the internet to be able to demonstrate stuff in the cyber labs because we had created these online cyber labs. So we went back to the United States, and I think we used at that point in time Zoom or maybe it was another remote desktop application and logged into a system that I had set up somewhere in the U.S. And it all went without any problem at all. And I'm quite certain the Chinese government was not interfering to allow me to do that from this unknown computer at a university somewhere in China.
It seems, despite your exhaustive defensive strategies, you still have a bit of a security problem, Headmaster. I'm afraid it's quite extensive.
One of my first internet stories, but you know, Tiananmen Square, was it 91, 92, right? It was before I got into security, before the firewall aid for me, and I got in an argument with somebody on Usenet and took it offline into an email thread, and we ended up agreeing on other things. And his son was a 21-year-old exchange student in China during Tiananmen Square. And because he'd been traveling around the countryside in those days, he had a laptop with a modem with alligator clips on it, any live pair of wires, right?
Yeah.
So his son was in a room facing in onto Tiananmen Square. You know, dial with a live telephone connection, so a modem connection into the university in Hong Kong and out to the world, and talking to his dad in Saskatchewan, Canada. You know, moment by moment as the tanks are rolling in Tiananmen Square, and you know the Chinese government, with all their you know power and influence at the time, couldn't stop this 21-year-old Canadian kid from reporting live.
When you say couldn't stop, it's not that they could not have stopped that; it's that with all the things you have to stop, they didn't stop them all.
Right.
Yeah.
And
this is the problem with an autocratic society, right? And this goes back to Mayfield's paradox in essence, right? It's impossible for nobody to know and it's impossible for everybody to know. Right. So, if it's a large enough event, people are going to find out. And we see that everywhere. I mean, that's lots of oppressive societies, you know, end up in the world court, you know, or wherever. And we find out about them, even, you know, 50 years later, if we find out, we still find out.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on The Cyber Show,
Bill manages the risks. John finds 95,000 security managers. Maria ends up in charge of physical and information security response at Cisco. Tom teaspoons his way to the top. Another company pitches, trying to get a hit. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.